Okay, so is mic working? Thanks. This is a Subway collaboration with Greg Morris at Harvard. I apologize for all the acronyms in the title. Another way of describing this work is software sandboxing, which explains the picture. So I'm first going to tell you about software-based fault isolation as a security technique in general. Then I'm going to tell you about a historic implementation that only works for risk architectures, and our new implementation that works for the x86. Then the details of the implementation we evaluated, and the machine check proof that we use to increase our confidence in the security that the technique is providing. So the problem we're addressing here is isolation of one module in a software system. So you have a piece of code. Either the author of that code is malicious, or the code might be in danger of being subverted by maliciously chosen inputs coming off the network. You want to keep that code from somehow doing any bad things. So the general technique here is to identify a set of interfaces to this code that should be all it's allowed to do and prevent it from doing anything else. And it's just implementing that I'm going to be talking about today. So just to give you something concrete to think about, here's one example where you'd like to do something like this, taken from another research project at MIT. If you have compressed archives that you'd like to be readable in the future without the recipients having every possible decompression tool, you'd like to embed a decompression library in the archive, and then it can be executed when the data is extracted. But you have to be sure, because these archives might be coming from an untrusted source, that you can execute that code in isolation. So all it can do is produce the uncompressed output. So there are a lot of well-known techniques that you can use for this kind of isolation. The process abstraction that your operating system gives you is one example. It has a very nice, robust, hardware-based enforcement mechanism. The one drawback of it, though, is that the system call interface is fixed, and it may not be what you want for your application. Another thing you can do is just rewrite all your code in a safe language like Java. That has the additional advantage of allowing safe sharing of fine-grained sharing of data between the sandbox code and the rest of the system. But if your code is written in an unsafe language, it's not so applicable. So the basic the expansion of this acronym, software-based fault isolation, refers to a technique that simulates the same kind of protection that you would get from hardware, but within a single process, just by rewriting the instructions of the code that you want to isolate, putting in checks before unsafe operations. So we want to isolate memory writes, control flow transfers, so right before any of those unsafe instructions, we put in some checks. So first I'm going to tell you about now the details of how you can do that on a risk architecture, and sort of the basic, how does that work? So the inserting checks seems like a pretty simple idea. The key problem is that the check is to make sure that the checks can't be subverted. So if you take just a look at this little example here, just the first two instructions. Suppose that at offset F04 we have in this notional risk architecture a certain unsafe operation that uses the register RS. So right before that, you put in a check of the value in the register RS. But if the rest of the code, if you don't have any much control over the rest of the code, the problem is how can you make sure that the check at F0 will always be executed before the F04 call? So if there's a jump in the code, a static jump like right here, you definitely want to disallow that. But the trickier problem is indirect jumps, where the place to jump is specified in a register, like down at the bottom. So you're checking the bounds of the, you do some sort of bounds check to see that the address where you're jumping is somewhere in the code. But how do you know that F00 is OK and F04 isn't? So a technique that works well on a risk architecture like the alpha is to reserve some registers for the sole purpose of using the sandbox areas. So for instance, we could say that all of the writes that we do to the sandbox area will use addresses through the RS register. And then we rewrite the code so that throughout execution, there's sort of this invariant that says RS always represents some legal address in the data area. And if you maintain that at all points, then it actually doesn't matter if the code jumps into the middle of the checks, because the value in RS will already have been protected. A disadvantage of this is it does require several registers. So based on that simple idea, then most of the rest of it is just optimization. How can we reduce the overhead of the basic technique? So one simple thing to do is to pick the size and location of the code and data areas to be sizes of, to be a power of 2, so that you can enforce the checks just with bitwise operations, since those are fast. Another optimization has to do with error reporting, or maybe I should say the lack thereof. So the sort of ideal you might want for a system like this is that if the original code was about to perform an unsafe operation, the rewritten code will instead halt with a nice error message. But you can save a little time if instead you change what you want to say, well, I would be okay if the rewritten code just does something else that's allowed by the security policy. So we're going to make sure, so if you try to write, say, outside the range, we'll make sure that that write actually goes inside the range, but avoid a branch, say, in this case. Some other optimizations I'll talk about briefly having to do with register usage. So a register like the frame pointer, which is used to access local variables, is usually initialized at the beginning of a function and then used over and over again. So you can save time by checking when it's modified rather than when it's used. An advance on that for something like the stack pointer, that's often moved by a small amount, is to put what are called guard pages at the beginning and the end of the data sandbox region. That are unmapped, so that you can catch access to them with a hardware mechanism. And then an instruction like push doesn't need any extra checks. So that works fine for our RISC architecture. Is there anything that goes wrong if I try to apply it to an x86 processor like the one in my laptop? And of course the answer is yes. The key problem in a CISC architecture is that the instructions are byte-based, and they could start at any byte. So there's some intent, there's probably some sequence of instructions that the code author intended, like the ones shown in yellow at the bottom of that diagram. And you can execute those. But if you try to jump to some other byte offset that's in the middle of one of those instructions, you'll get an alternate sequence of instructions, like the ones shown in green or red, that'll do something completely different. And it's pretty tricky to make all of the different streams of execution possible execution be safe because they're all sharing the same bytes. So borrowing a page from the RISC architecture, we can fix that by enforcing alignment artificially. So we choose our own size of alignment. It turns out that 16 bytes works well here. And insert no-op instructions for padding so that no instruction crosses a 16-byte boundary. Then whenever you do a jump, we make sure that the low bits of the jump address are 0. Related to that, if you have a function call instruction, it actually has to go at the end of one of these 16-byte chunks so that the address that you return to, which comes right after it, is aligned. And so using this technique, we can take an unsafe operation and the check and put them together in one 16-byte chunk. And that means we don't have to reserve any registers, though we still need a spare register to do the checks on the values. Let me tell you about a few more optimizations, since that's part of the name of the game here. If you have some additional control over the memory layout, you can pick the code and data regions so that the parts of their addresses that are the same have no bits in common. And then if you can also reserve the all zeros location at the bottom of the memory map, then you can get away with only one rather than two bitwise operations. To enforce that an address is safe, you only need to turn off bits in it, which you can do just with an AND. So a few things about the sort of the security context of this that I would guess are pretty obvious in this audience, but I should just say. We have a system where the compiler and the system that performs the rewriting I've just talked about aren't trusted. Instead, similar to something like the Java bytecode verifier, there's a separate trusted piece, a checker or verifier, whose job is to make sure that the rewriting has been performed correctly. And that can be very conservative. If it sees an instruction it doesn't like, it just throws it out. And with this architecture, you don't have to depend on the compiler doing the right thing. And because compilers are big and complicated, that's nice to be able to avoid. So next, let me tell you a few more details about our particular implementation, which we call Pittsfield, which stands for the Prototype IA32 Transformation Tool for Software-Based Fault Isolation Enabling Load Time Determinations of Safety. There's the URL, or you can Google for it. It's GPL, then you can download it right now. So I'd appreciate it if you wait until I stop talking. So the rewriting that I mentioned is performed by text processing. We have a little program that looks at the output of the assembler output of the compiler. It enforces alignment using some assembler directives and estimates of how long instructions will be. The key reason it makes sense to do this transformation at the assembly language level is that at that point all of the references between pieces of the code, like labels, are still symbolic. So here we can, if we want to insert instructions, we can just put them in and the assembler will fix up the jumps so they still go to the right place. The verifier is also, we also implement it to be quite simple. It works with just one pass from the beginning of the code to the end, and sort of just looking locally at the instructions it's looking at now. One way of thinking about it is that it's sort of a state machine where we keep track of an invariant at each point that says what do we definitely know about the values in the registers right now. And so you, because we're just doing this in one pass, we just have to be sort of conservative. If we're at a place where that might be a jump target, we have to forget, we have to pretend we don't know anything. And also, if we're going to jump, we sort of have to clean up any messes we've made so that the rest of it, so that the code that executes after the jump will still work. So I have a couple of slides about some performance evaluation of this tool. So we applied it to the standard specint benchmarks, which are just some compute-intensive programs. The top line shows you the summary. The time overhead was about 21% on average. The space increase was larger, about 75% overhead, though most of the instructions we add are sort of redundant. And that actually shows up in this last column, which is the ratio of the compressed size of the original program to the compressed size of the rewritten program. You can see that's much smaller. So I mentioned that demonstrates redundancy of the things we've added. You also, compressed size is also important if you're worrying, say, about how long will it take for my program to download for all of its users. So I want to tell you a little bit more about the time overhead, splitting it up. Here I've taken those same programs, actually ordered them from largest to smallest. So you can see there's some correlation where we have a larger overhead on larger programs. And then I've split up the sources of the overhead, which I'll talk about from bottom to top. So to start out with the purple at the bottom, to avoid some other performance problems later, we disable instruction scheduling, and that causes a small slowdown on some programs. Next, I mentioned we need a spare register to be able to do the check operations. So we did that by just asking GCC to completely keep its hands off the EBX register. And that has an overhead sometimes more than 10% depending on register pressure in the programs. However, the largest source of overhead here comes from all of these instructions we're adding. And I'm going to split that up in two pieces. The first one I want to explain is the orange bars here, which represents the overhead that comes from putting in enough no-op operations to make sure no instruction overlaps a 16-byte boundary, like I mentioned before. Now, I want to jump ahead a little bit to the end to say that the red bar at the top is the total overhead of our technique. And then the green bar right below it so we've introduced these instructions that, for instance, apply the AND instruction to addresses. The green bar comes from we sort of take all the same instructions we would normally add, but all of those ANDs we turn back into no-ops of the same length. So between the green and the green shows the slowdown that comes from adding more instructions, and the red shows the additional slowdown from what the instructions do. And again, this indicates it's mainly we're running out of space in the instruction cache. That's reducing the speed. So since this is a security mechanism, we're interested in what kind of security guarantee it's providing us. And the way we got some more information about that was with a machine check proof. So it's well known in security that redundancy is not a very effective design strategy. Instead, you want to have a small piece of your system that's responsible for security and then really work on making it secure. So in our case, that's the verifier. We really want to know that if our verifier says that the code is okay, then it really will be safe when we run it. And that's a very precise statement that we can actually try to prove. And in particular, we're going to use a machine check proof to try to increase the chances that we didn't make any stupid mistakes in writing it. So the tool we're using for that is a proof assistant called ACL2. The way that works is you model a problem by writing code in a restricted subset of common Lisp. And then you state a property you hope is true about that model. It would be nice if the system could then just say, yep, it's true, but we're not so lucky. Instead, the additional work you have to do is refine your goal statement into a lot of smaller sublemmas. And once you get all of those right, each one of the small steps of the proof can be checked automatically by ACL2. So sometimes you have to give it some hints. To summarize in one slide the statement that we're proving, so this verifier is modeled as just a simple predicate on the code that you're about to execute that says true if it's safe, if the verifier thinks it's safe, and false otherwise. And then my x86 processor is modeled just as an interpreter that runs one instruction after another according to the rules for a subset of the architecture. And we set up that interpreter so if the code tries to do anything unsafe, it'll halt. And also, I should say, there's no exit function for the model. So that makes the statement of the thing we want to prove fairly simple. It's that we say, for any code image, we want to know that if the code passes the verifier, then if you run that same code through the interpreter, it'll just run forever, meaning it will never do any unsafe operations. So we have pushed this proof through, verified the statement I showed you on the last slide for a representative, though small, subset of the x86 instruction set. So we chose these instructions to sort of exercise all the main things that code can do that we want to check, like indirect writes, indirect jumps, the special treatment of the frame pointer. Another thing that we thought was pretty important is to realistically model the way we do the padding and the particular instruction encoding that we're using, because that's an important part of why the technique works. So now I just want to give you a few concluding remarks to answer the question, what have we learned from this research? So I would say we've learned that it is possible to do SFI efficiently on a CISC architecture like the x86. It's possible to apply SFI to full-scale applications like the ones I've talked about. And because of the machine check proof, it's reasonable to actually have some trust that an SFI implementation really provides the security you'd like it to. Thank you.